Possession number 9338, reel 3.
Doug Turner, tape 3. Before I ask you more about your community in Suffolk, Doug, could I ask you a little more about the Bruderhof community in the Cotswolds, I think you said? When you went to stay there, did you have to pay anything?
No, it was... You were expected to go as a guest in the first place, and you just shared their life as they lived it. Obviously, you were expected to work in order to understand the life, and this working together really, I suppose, constitutes the main purpose of their life.
And to qualify for participation in this community, did you have to be a pacifist?
Do you mean if you joined as a member?
No, oh, to yeah. actually go and stay.
Oh, no,
there,
no. I mean, they welcomed all seeking people, whoever they were, provided they went with an open mind and not in order to disrupt the community, obviously. So there was always a constant flow of visitors going through. And, of course, many of these visitors... became so enthralled with the life that they stayed either for long periods and quite a number, of course, ultimately joined.
How self-sufficient would they have been, this community?
Well, when they first came to England, of course, they had hardly any money at all, and everything had been taken by the Nazi authorities and their schools had been broken up. So when they came, I think the Quakers helped them quite a bit to settle in and help them with loans and other gifts, and with a community of, I think, then about 100 and perhaps 250 people, there was quite a heavy burden. They all had families and they all had to be maintained, and they also had their own schools. Their life, their working life was on the farm. They were very, very well organised in their work order. They had a good market garden, dairy, general agriculture, wood turning, doing as many things for themselves as they possibly could, buying as little as they possibly could. Their life was very, very simple, and their food was very simple.
Did you find you could communicate with them? You know, did they speak English?
They spoke both languages. At meal tables, there would always be a reading from a book. One of the leaders would be reading from a book, and this would be read usually in German and would be interpreted then in English. Of course, if the book was in English, then it would be the other way around. But the language was both German and English at that time.
And would you say that was an important experience for your pacifism?
Yes, it was a very important step in my life, because it brought a coherence to my thinking in a kind of total way. It answered all my questions of living, economics, politics, religion. And poverty, I suppose. Looking at poverty in a creative sense, not just as a squalidness. Here were people who were living out of the Sermon on the Mount out. Had I been asked at the time, I think I might have, perhaps idealistically, but nevertheless at that time quite truly have said that it reflected the social order or the kingdom of God on earth.
Have you any idea what happened in the war to that community once the war had started?
Once the war had started, well, of course, all the English members had to register as conscientious objectors and duly appear before their tribunals. I don't think there was very much difficulty here, because the Bruderhof had a very good reputation for being hard-working and also for contributing to the economy of the country. Nevertheless, there were some voices in the local community who were very strongly opposed to them. I think mainly consisting more of the landed gentry around there who didn't like the idea of Germans being in their vicinity at all, though they must have known that they were fully anti-Nazi because of their experiences. Nevertheless, as time went on, they did bring quite a lot of pressure to bear upon the government, and in which ended rather sadly, I feel, for Britain's traditional freedoms, in the government feeling compelled to ask them to leave the country. This arose because of the pressure was so intense that the government rather reluctantly had to say to them, well, look, we've got to intern the German members of the community as aliens, or you'll have to leave the country. And this is what happened. But I would also say that this was not done with real government intentions. They were rather sad about it, and most MPs of all parties expressed a deep sympathy for the Bruderhof. It was largely due to the rather squalid attitude of certain gentry in the area.
Right, well, could I ask you now about the community that you belong to in Suffolk?
Yes, we managed to buy, as I said, this little farm in Elmsett, which is about 8 miles away from Ipswich, and there began our really hard graft, because we had no surplus money other than the what we had put in, and these amounted at the most to just a few pounds. Perhaps I ought to say something here about the members who constituted the community. Edmund, who had already spent a period at the Bruderhof in Germany and had also spent a period in the Palestinian kibbutz, was a very clear-headed young person. He was then about 24. And I think we felt that he was the great strength within the group. Most of us were fairly immature, one of them being a very young man of 17, having been attending a school in Reading, a private school, and having expressed his opinions, he found it very difficult to continue there because of the attitude of the school towards him. He had written a very fine article outlining such a way of living in Peace News a few months previously, and so we linked up with him.
What was his name?
His name was George Carnes. Another member was Horace Mayo. Horace was a clerk in an East End local authority. He came from an Anglican background. Then there was a Bert Shipley. Bert was older than the rest of us. He was then about 52 years of age and had been a petty officer in the Royal Navy and, of course, in the First World War. He had also been a boxing champion of his ship. He had quite the look of a bruiser about him, but he had a very, very soft heart, and he had was very active, had been very active in the socialist Christian movement in London. Then there was Geoffrey Watson, who had been at a blue coat school and had been intending to, I think, become a chartered accountant. Other members included Harry Coxedge, Edmund's younger brother, and we hadn't been there but a few weeks when we had a letter from a young Dutch girl who had heard about us and who came over and joined us as well. We incidentally had letters from all over the world. How they heard about us, I don't know, but they did. We had warm letters of support from Hungary, America, Egypt, Holland, many different countries. So this certainly gave us quite an ego boost.
What was the name of the Dutch girl?
Her name was Rim Jensma, J-E-N-S-M-A, I believe. When we arrived there, we weren't all that welcomed by the local populace. It is said that Suffolk people tend to be suspicious, and I think we experienced this. One or two people were friendly, but not many. They regarded us as I suppose rural people did then, as townies coming to farm and knowing very little about it, which was very true indeed. One of the most interesting, perhaps, contacts, however, was our neighbour, who had, when we arrived there, was quite an active member of the British Union of Fascists. It so happened that the BUF policy at that time was quite agriculturally oriented, and there had also been quite a few battles over the tithe issue. Harry Westron, the farmer concerned, in fact, had made quite a strong stand against paying tithes and had found himself losing quite a few of his possessions in the process. He, in turn, had linked up with a local Quaker farmer, Philip Butler, who, together with others in the farming community, had made their protest against paying tithes very strong. This had created quite a strong sense of unity at that level. Though, of course, our differences with Harry Westron on the political issue were very deep. Though I do believe that, like many farmers of the period, that their sympathies for the fascist movement were much more concerned with agriculture than any racial attitudes.
And Harry Westron would have been this fascist farmer, is that right?
He was a member of the British Union of Fascists, but he helped us quite a lot because he had the machines and we had the labour. Thus we did a very convenient swap here. He ploughed our fields and did all the work with the machines whilst we paid him back in labour at harvest time. It served a very useful purpose.
Did that create any dissonance, you know, the fact that you had to cooperate with a fascist?
No, it didn't really. After all, we wanted to reach out to people, and this gave us an opportunity also of reaching out to him as certainly a man who, in the normal way, politically, would have been in direct opposition. I don't think he ever saw it like this at all. His fascism was too shallow anyway. Although one interesting episode did occur, because during the weekends we would often go down to the local towns and sell peace news or even speak in the open. And on one occasion at the little market town of Hadley, we were speaking there in the open, and at the end we'd noticed a rather plump young man come along there with one or two other friends of his and stand by listening. And after the meeting was over, he came up to us, introduced himself, and said, "When I heard that you lot were coming here, I came with the intention of breaking up the meeting." And he introduced himself. He was a son of a wealthy local farmer and was also a fascist. And it had been his every intention to apparently break us up. But he had been so interested in what we had to say that instead of that it ended in a reasonably friendly discussion, and he later paid us a visit. He couldn't quite understand our approach, and yet he felt uncertain and uneasy about his own stand. he obviously didn't know where he stood himself, really. But I think it left in him almost a sense of longing for something he had never had. It was quite an interesting experience. And we found that quite frequently with perhaps people who weren't all that friendly inclined towards us in the first instance, found themselves listening.
Would you say that many of the farmers had leanings towards fascism for the reason, you know, you have outlined?
I don't know about many. I think there was a small group of them, a scattering of them, and I think this existed over the whole country. I think some of the big fascist meetings in London were strongly supported by certain agricultural interests. One name I can remember was the writer Henry Williamson.
And this business with the tithes, could you explain what that was? You know, the fact that they had to pay...
Well, this was part of the old Queen Anne's bounty, in which the church took one-tenth of the farmer's income. And that was that. And there was no way out. I mean, that was the law, and that was it took quite a long fight between government, farmers, and the church before the situation was ultimately resolved, as it was indeed.
Did you have many visitors?
Yes, we did indeed. I think we had some 200 in the first year. They came down for periods to stay with us, and one or two ultimately joined us as the months went on.
What was the maximum size that it grew to?
Now, the community itself was about, I think, grew to a maximum of about 12, but we were very overcrowded there. The cottage we had been a run-down farm. The farm had been a very run-down place. It had been deteriorating for some years, so that when we took it over, it was certainly a very sea farm, I should think, and we had to build it up. The cottage itself was very tiny, consisting of two rooms downstairs, a kitchen, and two bedrooms. So we had to do a lot of conversion. We converted one of the barns into a dormitory, into a dining room and living room, a general community room, and the three of the other rooms had to be turned into bedrooms, which just left the kitchen and the one room which we tried to keep as a quiet room.
What was your aim of this community?
We endeavoured to live out a full life of brotherhood there. As time went on and as we became enthused with the life, I think we often used to question one another as to whether we could ever go back into the world again as we saw it, and we found it extremely difficult to imagine going back into the life as we had known it. No matter what our different backgrounds had been, we had really made a complete break with the past.
And what did each of you bring to this in the way of sort of resources or money?
We brought very little ourselves in the way of possessions, nil in most cases, because we'd already lived quite simple lives. And strangely enough, it was one of those groups which was largely working class in origin, as perhaps rather distinct from maybe much of the pacifist movement.
So where did you get your money?
We very fortunately had a man named John Humphreys, an elderly man who was an old-fashioned anarchist, and he showed quite a warmth towards us, and having a little money of his own, he very generously offered a loan of £400 without interest. That gave us quite a boost, and he didn't object to our perhaps taking a religious stance. He felt that somebody was living out his own principles. But this, together with other small gifts, enabled us to start the place.
You were saying you had this religious stance. Was it a religious in sort of underpinning the community, would you say?
Basically, I suppose it was in the wider context of the word religion, we were completely non-denominational. And we didn't insist that people had to be religious at all. For example, one of our members, early members, a man I forgot to mention, Harry Webb, was an anarchist and had also been in the Spanish Civil War as an ambulance driver. Harry was a man of deep convictions, and he worked, was probably one of the best workers of the whole community. It was a very sad moment indeed when he felt perhaps he found that the community were beginning to move slowly towards a more specific religious feeling, that he as an atheist felt himself at odds with the rest of the community. And it was a very sad moment when he felt, a moment for all of us, when he felt he had to leave. We didn't want him to leave at all. It was his own choice. I think there were other psychological factors as well, as events turned out, which made his departure almost inevitable. I don't think it was wholly a religious situation, but to Harry at that time, it was.
Did you aim to be self-sufficient?
Yes, we did aim to be self-sufficient, certainly in our food. We lived very, very simply. One of the members, our Bert Shipley, our ex-Navy man, had to bring his elderly mother with him, she having no one to look after her. And he made that a condition of his joining, and we, in true Christian Brotherhood, decided that we would accept her into the community, not as a member, but as dependent. It was rather a sad decision on our part, because unfortunately Mrs. Shippey was not at all community-minded, and although she took upon herself the task of cooking for the whole community, having been a cateress in the past, living in the community was a terrible disaster for the whole future of the community.
Why was that? What was it about her?
Well, she was, of course, very much a part of the old order. Her loyalty to Bert was very deep, and Bert himself felt dual loyalties, one to the community and, of course, one to his mother, and at times he went through agony. And at times he felt himself having to side with his mother against the community, and at times siding with the community against his mother. It did not help the development of a real spirit of community at all, I fear.
But was there any room for individualism within a community like that?
There was always this existence, of course. I mean, we constantly fight our own individualism. It was it came out again and again. But generally speaking, certainly for that first year, there was a very real spirit of brotherhood. Tensions had already begun to arise. One or two members felt that they had to leave, and sadly we bade them farewell. But Rim also brought in a strong streak of individualism, which didn't help the community at times, and she and Horace decided to get married. We were not at all happy about this. We didn't feel that it would work out somehow. And in the end, it led to Horace and Rim departing, marrying. And later on, they paid a visit and wanted to come back. The community itself couldn't agree on whether we should receive them back or not. Ultimately, we didn't. Later on, in some years later, it ended up with Rim and Horace divorcing.
How successful were you, you know, at being self-sufficient? And did you expect to generate anything to sell? Yes, indeed.
We worked very hard trying to develop a market garden. It was almost an impossible task from the beginning. We hadn't machines. The soil was exceedingly heavy. And we spent long, long hours digging ditches, laying new drains, digging heavy clay soil, sticky, heavy yellow clay soil, until our backs were breaking. We did it. We enjoyed it. We grew sugar beet, we grew wheat, we tried to develop a market garden. We developed a small sale outside, and I took on the task of opening up a small shop in Ipswich and having a small round there from which we sold our eggs and our vegetables and occasionally a few items of fruit. It wasn't very successful. Half farming at that time indeed was very hard hit, and we had to maintain a community of some 10 or 12 people on a very small acreage. Nevertheless, we did improve the farm. We had the advice of our neighbour, and we had our labour, but it never paid. I don't recall what our actual income was, but I do recall what our cost of living was per week, and that amounted, I think, to about 3 and 6 a week per person per week. We, of course, gave ourselves no wages or any pocket money.
How would that relate to money today, do you think?
It was 18 pence a week. Because we tried to live on our own resources as much as possible. Bread we had to buy. But eggs we had, although we tried to sell most of those. And we also had goats, from whom we were able to obtain milk. We also lived on a breakfast cereal, which we made out of whole wheat, which we called, was known as frumity. This meant soaking the wheat at night, overnight, and by the morning it was swollen, of course, and then we were able to eat it with milk and sugar. Have a get played with our tummies is best imagined, perhaps.
Did you keep healthy?
Yes, we did. We kept very, very healthy. We worked hard. We worked long. Our first and second winters were brutal. They were the most terrible winters I think England's had for a long time. The winter of 1939 extended from January to February, and then we had a wonderful spring, which gave us quite a boost. But we lived mainly on apple core jam, which Mrs. Shipley made. Selling most of the apples, we lived on apple core jam. We also grew our own wheat, and thus we were able to